Our world is built with stories.
Sometimes these stories cause suffering by pulling us apart from ourselves and each other.
The Liturgist podcast helps people love more and suffer less by pulling apart the stories that pull us apart.
Today's story, dissonance should be avoided. So I had this roommate in college named Jared, and he was a Catholic guy, and I was an evangelical, fervent missionary of all who were not evangelicals. And he was my roommate, and it was my first kind of close relationship, really, with anybody who wasn't an evangelical Christian. And we would talk about God, and I was always, at the beginning especially, I was kind of like, always a little like, but you know, you're Catholic, or you're like worshiping idols, right? You pray to Mary and you don't fully get the thing. But then the more we talked, I would find out like he really loved Jesus, and I was like, oh man, I guess maybe he's a Christian, you know? And I had these experiences with him, talking with him, and it was starting to open me up. But then it came to a head at this one point, because he was telling me about his family who had all been, they were all Christian except for his dad. And he had told me enough about his dad. I knew his dad was a really loving, great guy. He was like a rocket scientist, brilliant mind, good heart, loved the family, but he just wasn't interested in religion. He was an atheist. And I had this feeling, I remember like these two incredibly strong impulses and beliefs internally. One was, I knew that God was good and fair and kind and loving and loved all of his children. But then on the other hand, I knew that the word of God was true and that salvation could only come to those who believe. I had these two very strong, complete beliefs. And then in this moment where he's talking to me about his dad, and he goes, well, you don't think my dad's going to go to hell, right? I mean, he's a loving man. He serves us. Isn't that what God is asking us to do? And so whatever this thing kind of came to a head in me were these two very strong energies and beliefs were completely in contradiction. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of this watershed like moment for me as I look back of really, which one of these am I going to lean into? How can these coexist? How can these two separate contradictory pieces of dissonance exist in the same space in my mind, in my body? And as I think back of, that's just one story that came to my mind as I was beginning to think about this idea of living with dissonance and not rejecting dissonance as something that is necessarily inherently bad or needing to be avoided. But it made me wonder, like, what do we do with dissonance when we recognize it in ourselves? How do we think about it? How do we approach it? Because I know for me, those moments that have created dissonance, where I find these apparently contradictory things, either within myself or within community, in my experience, they've been an invitation to newness, to grow, to make more space for that dissonance to create something new. But that's hard and it's uncomfortable. And so that's, I don't know, there's an introductory story to get the ball rolling. What do you guys think? How have you experienced dissonance?
I think dissonance is most pronounced during like spiritual deconstruction. At least that's been my experience. So kind of what you're talking about, meeting your Catholic roommate and then, you know, having to be forced to reconcile certain ideas that seem, you know, discordant. Like I felt the same way, you know, working in mega churches or traveling and singing in churches. There became a point where it felt like what I felt on the inside about who I believe God to be and how I viewed myself and others started to, it was always, to be honest, there was always a bit of dissonance there, with especially growing up in the Black church and then primarily my adult life working in white churches, in terms of the cultural values that are there that are just different or the theological values that are different. But I think there came a point in my own spiritual growth and evolution where the dissonance became like it just rang so loud and it was unavoidable. And I feel like those are often tipping points into, you know, what we call spiritual deconstruction or even like, you know, depression, or it can cause like real trauma in people when the dissonance in their lives between who they are on the inside or and things they have to participate with on the outside, or how they believe about the world, you know, when they come into conflict. So dissonance, I think to some level, this is just my opinion, but I think dissonance to some level can be okay and can actually be healthy. And then I do think dissonance at some level can just bring chaos. And it just can be torturous. And so you have to then make life decisions. You have to make new theological assumptions. You have to make, you know, new assumptions about reality. You have to make, you have to either change your thoughts, you know, or you have to rationalize something. Like something always has to give. Otherwise, I think there's a level of dissonance, and maybe that's different for each person, but there's a level of dissonance that, I think is not okay to handle actually for some of us, for probably for all of us. You can only take it for so long.
You basically just gave an overview of Festinger's A Theory of Dissonance.
well, there you go.
Yeah. He gave us this theory of cognitive dissonance in the late 50s to describe that feeling that we get when there are two things that are seemingly inconsistent or at odds with each other that we're holding in the same time, or the other side of it too, which is when we behave one way but actually believe a different thing. And when we feel that dissonance in ourselves and we're like, why am I doing that thing even though I believe this thing over here? And essentially what comes up for us is the need to resolve the dissonance, because it's so intolerable for us. It actually stirs up all sorts of activation in different neuroanatomical structures that are really create this sensation of intolerability. And so we have some choices, like what do we do when we notice that dissonance in us? And like you said, something has to change. We can't stay there. We can expand, or we can move into our defenses and reject it, but it's meant to signal to us that these things are incongruent. And I think as beings, to be whole, we long for congruence. We long for things to feel like they are known and in a whole instead of at odds. And so we have, like you were saying, the choice to expand what we believe, to include the dissonant parts within a greater whole, or we kind of shut ourselves down a bit. There are these... What prompted you to do it? I want to hear what you're going to do.
No, keep going and I'll get to it.
Okay. That there are these different ways of looking at cognitions within us. And that's what we're thinking of as being the stuff that creates the dissonance. There's this consonant relationship between thoughts or beliefs. So two beliefs or two actions or an action and belief are consistent with each other. Like I want to meditate daily, and I am meditating daily. So those are consonant. They're not in tension. And then there's the irrelevant relationship between things. I want to meditate daily, and I had curry for lunch. These are not related or at odds with each other. And then we have the dissonant relationship, which is I want to meditate daily, and I'm not meditating daily. Or I value people who tell the truth, but then I lie. And that's where the dissonance comes in, is that we're seeing things that we link as being related to each other as being inconsistent. And we have some choices about what we do with that. There is, you know, we just change how we think. I'm really just overviewing what you said already, William. Like, okay, let's just say the behavior that we want to change is that we're scrolling on our phone constantly. And the belief that I hold is that being on my phone constantly is actually not so great for my frontal lobe and my attention systems. So what do I do when I feel that dissonance where I'm saying like, oh, I don't want to be on my phone so much, but here I am scrolling constantly.
Yeah.
We change the thought, right? So we're just like, okay, you know what? I'm just going to stop scrolling on my phone. I'm just going to stop doing that. And we justify the behavior. We say, you know what? I'm allowed to go on my phone once in a while, as long as it's for a short amount of time. So we come up with these rules that allow us to continue to do the thing or believe the thing we want to believe. Or we justify our behavior by adding in something new. So we say like, okay, for every extra minute I'm mindlessly on my phone, I'm going to spend an extra minute meditating. Or lastly, we just totally deny the information that creates the conflict in the first place. And we say, it doesn't even matter that I'm on my phone. Who cares? Like, I'm connecting to my friends and my family. And I actually, you know what? How about this? I'm reading about mental health and I'm reading about attention systems while I'm on my phone. Yeah. So that's how I can justify it. But the point is that when it comes up, it like triggers this discomfort in us that's intolerable. And so we have a few different ways of moving through it, but something has to happen.
Okay.
And it's meant to. The dissonance is meant to signal to us something needs to change.
Can I ask, so all the things that you mentioned in terms of, you know, your response or, you know, to the dissonance, all the different types of responses, is that necessarily, are there any of those responses inherently in and of themselves bad? Because when I was listening to them, I could easily see how, I guess, they can't, each of those things, you know, could be coping mechanisms or be bad or not, right? Like, is in that theory, is it giving an intrinsic value of like moral goodness or badness, I guess, to any of those types of rationalizations, so to speak?
No. And I think that's such an important question, because we have this tendency to create the hierarchy. I think probably among our listenership, these are people who like want to be healthy and want to be connected and want to do things that help them grow. And so we can look at these different responses and assume somehow one is better than the other. But I might contextualize it in light of what do we need in that moment? What is helping us survive? What is essential for our ability to endure? And based on our hierarchy of needs, we can pretty quickly override what would be ideal when we are safe just to adapt to get through. Like, I think about for people who've experienced abuse at the hands of their parents, one of the markers of this dissonance when a person is holding this belief, like, but my parents are supposed to take care of me and they're abusing me. There is no way to keep being in a relationship with someone that's abusing you, except in some ways to move into this like denial of what's going on and to join with that person who's abusing you, because it's going to cause even more distress, even more violence, to be at odds with them, to say, hey, you can't treat me that way. So in that situation, like, that's a pretty typical thing that we would see in therapy, that a person who's been abused can't name what the abuse has been like if that person has also been a position of care for them. So maybe it's more like, what do I need to do to survive? And if we feel like our ability to survive is tied to going along with one of these two opposing beliefs, we're probably, without even thinking about it, going to choose that one, because it would cost our nervous system way too much to do something else. So even being in the space where we could confront the dissonance requires a level of, we could say, safety or security or privilege or the ability to know, hey, this isn't actually going to cost me everything. But that, I mean, your point earlier, William, is so important, because I think that's where it gets complicated for people who've done deconstruction. We've been told that holding these specific beliefs is how you survive for eternity. And when you've been told that enough times, you can't extract that from the survival instinct. So we'll protect that at all costs, because we believe it's essential for our survival to believe that one story.
My sister, yeah. My sister told me a story recently that I actually forgot about, my older sister. And it, to me, it kind of talks about how, to a level, Black people always have to live with a certain type of cognitive dissonance. And the story was simple. Like, I think I was probably 6 or 7, 8 years old. And we were at this museum, and they were asking, you know, questions about history, and they were like, for little kids. And so I went up to answer one of the questions. And one of the questions, you know, was, who created the light bulb? And then I said, Louis Latimer, who's an African-American inventor who, yes, created the first light bulb. But I got the answer wrong. Because they said, no, it's Thomas Edison, right? And now, to my little, you know, 7-year-old brain, I'm like, but no, like, it was Lewis Latimer. Like, you guys are wrong. And my sister said she remembers my parents had to like pull me aside because I was like kind of having like a bit of a traumatic experience of like, no, like you guys are wrong, you know? And she said my parents had to like explain to me like, hey, there are people in the world that just don't value Black history, or they don't know the truth of it. And like, and I had to like, and my sister said, like, she reminded me of this very recently. She's like, I was crying. And so there was like this introduction of dissonance to the world of like, oh, to survive in the world, I have to answer the questions the way you say, or the your answers have to be right, even if they're not categorically right as you know, far as we understand history. But I would say, looking back at that experience, having my sister recount that experience to me, I could see how that could, how that made an imprint on my brain of the world that I live in, that I can't uniquely trust the world that I live in, or that the world that I live in is more interested in its own mythology rather than actual truth. And that's a like you described, that's a type of real trauma, a physical discomfort that happens, you know, and then over time, like the way that compounds and that narrative is built. I feel like I've been living with cognitive dissonance for all of my life, like we all have. But you know, when you're a minority in a, you know, dominant system, you just constantly are always, there's a stress there because you are always the one being told you're either lesser than, or you don't matter, your history doesn't matter, your family's history doesn't matter. Yeah.
I hear that moment of dissonance that must have happened for you as a kid, right? That distress of like, how can these two things be true? And how can I be wrong about something that I know isn't wrong?
Yeah.
And then I think about what happened after in terms of your parents expanding your worldview to say, here's why those two things, why that just happened. And so here's this larger story.
Yeah.
And I imagine for so many people who move out of dissonance to get an understanding, the trauma isn't over because you're then seeing the injustice. So now you're out of dissonance, but you're not out of the pain state.
Yeah.
Because you're feeling like that's wrong, that there's a wrongness to the fact that those two things are allowed to happen side by side. And then again, the pain doesn't discontinue because you know that. Then we actually have to be in grief or anger and try and change the system. But that moment specifically of dissonance really stands out to me, of you being a kid and being, how can these two things be true at the same time?
Yeah.
And that, like, when we think about cognitive dissonance from a psychological perspective, that's the moment of like, but these two things can't coexist, and now I'm distressed.
Wow. This is why I need a therapy session.
Yeah, there's like a
okay.
What?
If I did therapy with you, William, I would fuck you up.
I know you would. That's why I refuse. I'm like, I'm not going to let her destroy my ego.
It is like, I think about it musically and how certain kinds of music will, how they treat dissonance. Like certain kinds of music, there's no room for dissonance. Like when you're singing Kumbaya, if we have like Kumbaya, my Lord, and somebody goes, throws that in there, it's an, wrong, sorry, mistake, because that music doesn't have any room for that sort of dissonance. And then I think about that chord that I just played is the chord from The Rite of Spring, which is a crazy chord because it's like an E major on the bottom, and then an E flat dominant on the top in the first inversion. So, to, you know, either of those by themselves can fit into most music. There's plenty of room for that kind of dissonance. Like the E major chord has any dissonance. The E flat 7 chord has like a little bit, but not very much. But you put them together, it does not work for most music. But what happens like musically then is rather than just being a passing thing that resolves very quickly, Stravinsky just like sits on it, just like holds it there. And eventually, like, you sit with it long enough, and he just holds it there forever. And eventually, like, those two competing things, which most music you're going to want to pick, this one or this one, and then repress the other one. Like, get that out of here. But by sitting with both, it actually opens up, like, a new space that is that its own, this new chord, this new feeling that is, it includes both, but it transcends both somehow. It's like there's more space that's opened up. And it's incredibly, for like the people that first heard it, reportedly, they were like freaked out in the audience and just hated it. And people were like old ladies hitting people with umbrellas and shit. Like, the stories are crazy about this, what happened when it premiered. But there's something that happens when you just sit with dissonance, and it has to go somewhere. Right. And so you either have this idea, like when you're confronted with it, it is an opportunity to either repress and pick and like, you know, hide some aspect of reality or what your experience is and just pick one of them, like Hillary's talking about, or if you have the ability to be able to sit with it and allow whatever new space is created from just having to sit with it and not pushing aside either of the things, either chord, it can create growth, because it can create new, it is literally like new space. It's a bigger space. There's more happening in the space. I think that's a cool way of feeling, and when you experience dissonance, in inviting you potentially into newness.
That sounds like the perfect metaphor for what happened with Jared. Like you had this new, like you're using this analogy or this example musically, sounds like it represents what happened internally for you, like more space opened up, a space that was big enough to hold him and his beliefs and you and your beliefs in something that was so much wider and more loving.
Yeah. And I think that any time I look through my life of any period of growth, that's what it's been. When I think about Lucy being born and knowing we can't handle this. Like, we can't, our life was already crazy. We were on the road all the time. We don't have the ability to have a child with special needs. And we have a child with special needs.
Right. Yeah.
So now what? Now what are we going to do? Sometimes that dissonance of life where you just know, like, this is not possible. And also, it's what's happening. Now we have to figure out a new way to be, because they both exist. I could say story after story of times in my life where I feel like there was the most growth, the most evolution in a good way. The times of my life where I probably avoided it, that were a chance for growth that I missed out on because I didn't have the space. And I do think what you brought up, William, moralizing this can actually, I don't know, be counterproductive in a way. Like, if you feel like you have to sit with the dissonance, that's just kind of oppressive, and it doesn't actually allow the room that you might need to be able to really open your hands and your heart to what might need to be if it's being forced on you.
Yeah.
So I certainly wouldn't moralize this, but if you have the opportunity to not repress, if you have the opportunity to actually get some space and sit with some dissonance for a while, it can be incredibly empowering and help you grow.
Yeah. There's this language that's used often in charismatic, prophetic Christian world, which I actually do think is partially helpful, maybe in something like this. You know, in those environments, you always get told, you know, I just feel like the Lord is inviting you into something, right? Like, if you ever got a prophetic word, you've probably heard that. I think those things are invitations rather than commandments, right? Like, because ultimately, where people are and how they're coping with what they're coping with, I don't think you can always force people into or demand for them to be a quote unquote good person, then they must blah, 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 blah. I think, you know, people are coping with how they're coping. But I do think the invitation exists. And some of the pain in which, you know, people are in their current silos might feel, maybe parts of their pain are rationalized in the echo chamber they're in, but then there's maybe another deeper longing or pain that is going, you know, unnoticed, that maybe an invitation to seeing the world a different way or sitting with dissonance in a different way, you know, could help them too. But you're right. Moralizing it all, I think is very problematic, and it's also just not really helpful for the most part, or for most people, I believe.
And if we flip it around, we could see that getting away from the dissonance by moving into, like, ignoring or denying information could also be really actually the most ideal response. Like, if you, let's just say somebody close to me or someone in my life, like let's say one of you guys started calling me Angela, I would experience cognitive dissonance because it would interrupt my understanding of my reality, both what our relationships have been like up until this time and the fact that you know that my name is Hillary and the fact that everyone my entire life has called me Hillary. So I would experience some dissonance. It would be so uncomfortable. I would have to resolve it in some way. And I could respond by saying, hey, I'm going to try to correct you and I'm going to try and change your behavior or your belief. Or I could not interact with you anymore because I'd feel so unseen or so like, what's happening here? And so our dissonance doesn't necessarily tell us that we're wrong. Our dissonance tells us that there's some incongruence between our experience of reality up until that point and our expectation of what should happen moving forward. But that's where we can't have this conversation without also talking about ontology, like what is real. And sometimes our perceptions of reality, we want to hold, like, I would like to hold that my name is Hillary, that's inherently my name. But there are other times when there is something that's been so real for me, perhaps a belief about myself, that if you confront that and challenge that, I need to override the dissonance to adhere to actually what you're saying, because it's more true about me than whatever I've believed about myself. So we have to think about dissonance not necessarily as being good or bad and what we do as being good or bad, but how does it move us towards more of who we want to be, or how is it supporting us to be well or helping us survive? How is our response getting us something? What is it getting us? And perhaps what it's getting us is like more wholeness. How we respond is getting us more wholeness, and other times how we respond is keeping us feeling safe. And I don't know if either of those are bad or good. They just are.
Well, you guys can call me Angela if you want, and I would love to experience that dissonance as a possibility.
Well, how it shows up in therapy, like that's a really kind of bizarre example, but where it actually shows up for most of us is someone who has this deeply held belief, like I'm bad and I'm broken. And I sit across from them in a room and I say, wow, look at how good your defensive strategy is. Wow, it's really helped you. And they're like, wait a second, how could any part of me be good? How could this thing that I hate that I'm actually coming to treatment for be good? I had someone this week almost totally dissociate when I confronted their deeply held belief and said, I see it differently, because it was so overwhelming for them that it was kind of like there was no way to manage being in that moment. If I'm really bad, I can't actually be in this moment if you're telling me I'm good. It's so incomprehensible to me.
Well, I don't care what any of y'all think. I was being funny.
Just about any, just blanket statement.
Just blanket.
Yeah. I just realized, like, that's like, you know, there's a part of this. Brilliant. That's how I deal with cognitive dissonance sometimes. I'm just like, I don't care what you think. Like, You know, like, and I like information. Like, I'm a Enneagram 5. You know, like, I love in knowing and perceiving is how, like, I, you know, that makes me feel in control. You know, but then sometimes I'm just like, nah. and it's funny because I used to feel bad because I used to feel like I had to be accountable to everything I ever heard and I had to search it out to figure out if it was all true. And I don't feel that pressure anymore like I used to when I was younger to have it all figured out or have to, you know. I'm like, that doesn't make sense. If it doesn't sit right with me or anything I hear, it doesn't matter who it is. If you're telling me, I'm either going to receive it, I'm going to utterly reject it, or at best, I'm going to put it on a shelf and say, I don't know about that. Let me just set that right there. And then maybe if that thing keeps coming around or I keep hearing about it, you know, maybe I should look into that a little bit more. But I'm also not afraid to reject certain ideas. I'm also not afraid to say, you know what, whether that's coming from a place of just my brain rationalizing it or if, you know, or it's, I mean, I guess it's all a self-protection then, right? Because, you know, I'm going, hey, that's a harmful idea. I believe that's a harmful idea that's going to hurt me for whatever reason, you know, good, bad, in between. So no, I reject that idea. But I also think, you know, I've learned to just use that analogy of the shelf to help me navigate reality. Like, okay, I don't know about that and I don't need to know right now. So I'm just going to put that on a shelf because that's interesting. Maybe there's some truth in that. Not sure. You go on the shelf, but you know, the rest of you, I don't got to listen to you. So.
That sounds so coherent and self-caring to have that system to sort your experiences and figure out how you want to respond.
Yeah. It hard fought because like I said, I used to feel like I have to take it all in. Like I had to receive it all, like to be a good person meant you had an open heart and you had to receive everything from everyone. And I've just learned that just, you can't live that way. You can't base your life on fundamentally, you know, allowing people to toss you back and forth, you know, with every new bit of information or every, like, you just got to like dig your feet into the ground a little bit enough to be like, all right, I'm here. Here's where I am. Or this is how I perceive myself to be. And then I get to choose how I'm filtering and letting you all in and out of that. And I don't know. That's how I've survived some of the craziest situations of my life or the craziest environments where, you know, cognitive dissonance is everywhere. You're just like, you know, what is going on here? Like you walk into spaces or, you know, workspaces or you're just like, if you're not rooted in that. And that's why I think spirituality is important, because what it does is it ultimately roots you. So that way you walk into those spaces and you can process what's happening in a way that doesn't, you know, make you always spiral or always, you know, fall into a shame thing.
I don't know if how you, if you meant this in this way, but when I think about like how spirituality roots you, I agree with that. For me, how it rooted me was actually in identifying not so strongly with those things that are tossed back and forth. It was so easy for me, so much of my life living in my head, to identify with the thoughts, with the beliefs, that they were part of my identity. And so when they would get tossed back and forth, I was being tossed back and forth. And what spirituality has invited me into is finding the ground under that that doesn't move, finding the ocean under the waves that are the waves, that not identifying just with the movement so that I can't be thrown anywhere. I am that which is prior to movement of all of these ideas. And I don't know if that's how you meant it, but that's how I'm.
Yeah, maybe yes and no. You know, so I think I have a strong belief, and I'll just go, it's the belief that, you know, the ego is not simply, you know, because we always talk about the ego or the false sense of self, and it always has the negative connotation. But actually, you know, non-dual thinking would teach us that, you know, there are parts of the ego that are very good. So what parts of my ego are good, are helpful? And how can I stay rooted in that and not let information that's coming in destroy my sense of self-worth? And maybe, again, it might just be my experience of like being black in a white world, where it's like I actually find strength and comfort in the parts of my ego that are good, like whether it's my culture, whether it's the cultural values that I come from. And those things feel very cemented and firm and solid with me. Like I can intellectually articulate with you and say, yeah, sure, that those are metaphors. That's just language. Those are just cultural traditions passed down. And, you know, and there's a real beyond that. But in a strange way, I feel that what actually helps ground me is the appreciation of my inherent dignity, but also the inherent dignity of the people who produced me and where I come from and the good things about that, like in being rooted in that sense of tradition and legacy, gives me a sense of like groundedness, and a sense of, yeah, I know who I am and I know where I come from and you can't tell me shit about it. So, cause you don't know me and you don't know where I come from. So, You don't have the experiences that I have. You don't have the family background that I have. You don't have the spiritual background that I have. And so, I don't know. I see what you're saying. In one sense, sure, there is like, you know, the real that's beyond all of our temporalness. But I think that the good part of the ego, so to speak, just using, maybe that's not a good word, is also in connection to that thing that's real. You know, that's way beyond our understanding and way beyond our cultural metaphors, and the ways in which we unite with each other, you know, around, you know, religion or ethnicity or any of those things. So I don't see them as disconnected or just, I see them as intricately connected. And in fact, religion or that sense of ground, good ego and groundedness from where I come from and who I am, if anything, it can be a doorway to me to the cosmos, the greater understanding that that we just don't have language for, the thing that the real beyond the real, if that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense at all, but that's kind of, I think, in my head how I,
yeah,
how I connect those things.
Yeah, I certainly don't. Yeah, I certainly don't dismiss the ego as a bad thing. The ego's a wonderful tool for keeping organisms like these alive. And to me, it's no less part of God than anything else. Beautiful how you can tap into whatever you need to feel grounded and enjoy your life. I'm certainly never going to put any shoulds on anybody else. For me, putting too much identity, it's a matter of identity for me. Like, if I put too much identity in any of the ego things or really any ideas of separateness, I just start suffering a lot. And I've just become too weak to suffer, apparently. In most ways, I don't know. What were you going to say before, Hillary?
I was just going to throw it back to you because I noticed that difference too in you saying right off the top, dissonance is this invitation. And here we're also hearing Mike Williams say, actually, dissonance is something I have a few different responses to. And it's a skill I've learned to be able to know when I'm not opening myself up to what's dissonant.
Yeah.
So I was just curious about that. But I'm sure there's people who've been thinking about this extensively and it's only new to me, but I'm curious about the relationship between non-dual spirituality and identity politics.
Yeah.
And
whoa.
What it means to do non-dual spirituality when the justice movements that we're seeing are related to a reclaiming of identity that's been oppressed, marginalized, or silenced, and how moving into further identification with identity feels liberating. And yet how, I wonder if there's people who negotiate them both, where there's also kind of like a letting go of identity in a way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think if anything, that is the work of Black liberation theology. So think of it like James Cone, who is the founder of Black liberation theology. But you know, there were precursors like Howard Thurman. I would say Franz Fanon, though not Christian, was very much influential in some of these thinkings for the civil rights and the Black Power movement. But James Cone in particular, being the kind of pinnacle of the revelation, the thing that he constantly said was during the 60s was like, what happened in the 60s, the Cultural Revolution, was not just Black people resisting and fighting for human rights, but it was also an embrace of Black humanity and Black dignity. And so let's call it Black identity, right? And then from there, you got the Black power movement that emerges, like right after, in the form of Black Panthers, Malcolm X, you know, into the 70s. And you see this Black empowerment, like Black becomes a good word. It was almost like the reclaiming of what white supremacy was taking and saying, no, Black is beautiful. Like Malcolm X says, like, who taught you to hate the shape of your nose? Who taught you to hate the color of your hair? Who taught you to hate, you know, the hue of your skin, right? Like there was this sense of I'm Black and I'm proud. I'm okay. So what James Cone with Black liberation theology was holding in tandem, the dissonance that James Cone was holding was, how can I be, I want to be Black and proud and love who I am, love my culture, love my people, love my identity, but I'm also a Christian. I also identify with this idea of a crucified God. How do those things, do they go together? Because a lot of the Black power struggle or the Black power movements rejected Christianity as simply, you know, a tool of oppression for the white man. And so I think in liberation theologies, particularly, I mean, and it's not just Black liberation theology, you have Palestinian liberation theology. I mean, it started in South America, you know, and the liberation theology out of the preferential option of the poor. I think that is actually the best, the beginning landscape for us to begin to move in that direction of how do we love our bodies, love our humanity, love our culture, and still open ourselves up to that which is transcendent and bigger than any one cultural value or any one group can own or attest to. I'm just speaking of this as a question. I'm not providing any answers because I think we're all the living experiments of it. And the justice movements that you're mentioning, it's a living experiment. It's not a result, like a concrete, like we figured it out exactly right. Like I think people in right now here to this day, LGBT people, are trying to figure out, how do I retain my identity that feels as real to me as everything I can taste, smell, and touch, as well as with the call to transcendence or the call to service of humanity and giving up my life for another. Like, how do I, can I keep my life and save it? I don't know. Maybe you can, maybe you can't. I think that's my question too. And it's always to me a lifelong, it's going to be my lifelong question probably.
I think that any non-dual teacher that teaches non-duality in a way that makes it feel like people should be experiencing non-duality, as though people striving for their identities, to reclaim identities or whatever, if there's some sort of negative spin to that or moralization again of that people shouldn't be claiming their identities, that's not true non-duality. That's a teacher who's using non-dual language for his or her own ego purposes. It's not actually non-duality. So non-duality is basically, it would recognize that all of it belongs, including the striving for identity to be reclaimed and the power and the pride that comes with all of it. The formation of ego is no less godly than the dissolution of it. It's all part of what is. It's all part of this. It's all part of God. And so I hear what you're saying, William, in these great movements and these great thinkers and thought leaders, and I'm inspired by it, and I'm like, wow, it's beautiful. I also think that any identification as a self comes with inherent suffering, whether that self is rooted in like a larger collective self. There is a like sort of a wound that happens existentially that separates one part of reality from another. And I think that wound, when it says, okay, I'm this part of reality and I'm not this part, that wound is inherently, it includes suffering. And that's hard, like when we moralize suffering and we say you shouldn't be suffering, then that sounds like bad things. It can sound to the person identifying as a self like you shouldn't be identifying as a self. And no, that's not what non-duality would say at all. That's part of the beautiful aspect of what Goddess is doing. So it moves that dissonance that we're coming up here with is another chance. Here it is right in front of us. Here's a chance to say yes. Yes. Here's all these identities striving for justice and equality and peace and love. And wow, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it perfect? And all of that is an illusory movement within the ocean of God. Yes. And to identify or not identify as a self, there's no moralization for that to me at all. There's no hierarchy of that. There's no better or worse. Just for me personally, like in this body, the holding on to what I feel as myself comes with the amount of suffering that this body's not able to handle anymore. It's just kind of like it died to be able to handle that amount of suffering. And that's not a moral high ground at all, at all. So that's where I think where non-duality can get misinterpreted or mistaught is when it's moralized in some way, or when it's taught as though you should be, if you're really something, then you'll get to this place where you're not a self anymore. And that would be, who else would say that but an ego?
Well, yeah, sure. I just think what's hard about the non-dual conversation, usually inside of justice movements, is because there does seem to be this aesthetic of wanting to not suffer, right? That often happens, which, you know, you described as part of your experience of like, you know, you're like, hey, I don't think I like suffering, so maybe this is why I'm like attracted to these beliefs. But I think, you know, and I think justice people would argue and say, yeah, well, the only reason why the self is suffering is because other self-proclaimed selves are saying myself should not exist, right? Or myself shouldn't, you know, have access or power or whatever. And so, I don't know. I think we have, as long as we have on this life to live in the bodies that we have with the selves that we have, whenever we die, whatever happens in that, we will be in the real. We will not be suffering when we die, you know, after we pass on. And so I've got all this life to suffer, and that kind of seems to be the point. So I sometimes struggle with the non-dual conversation because I'm like, well, yeah, sure, you can alleviate suffering in this life, and that's helpful. Because I think there's a such thing as too much suffering. I think there's over-suffering. I think certain groups of people experience more suffering than other people, and it's unnecessary. So there is an aspect of, yes, I want to alleviate suffering, but I don't think, I think the idea of getting rid of identity or self in order to not suffer just feels like, well, that's going to happen in the afterlife. So, and I only got this life to live right now. So I'm going to be a self. You be a self, and we're gonna figure this out. And then once we're done, we could be in the ether, just like kicking it in peace, not suffering. And we'll be like, wow, wonderful, great. I don't know what heaven is. I don't know if there is a heaven. I don't know if it's, you know, whatever this happens on the other end of that, we'll be at peace. So until then, I'm like, I am a self and I am here, and I'm just trying to, I can alleviate suffering as best as I can, but I can't, you know, I can't remove it completely. So don't get in my way. That's how I feel.
I wanted to say something, but Hillary, you haven't spoken in a minute.
I could listen to this all day. This is great. I did have a thought that I can add later, but it's to change directions a little bit. So okay. Let's keep going. Yeah.
Okay, so there was this one aspect. Like, first of all, William, I love it. I'm legitimately delighted in your bravery to surf the suffering of the world as a participant in it. It's fantastic.
Listen, a lot of it's brought to me, but okay, yeah.
Well, but that's the part that I would disagree with, is that I don't think that suffering is external. When I'm talking about suffering, I'm not talking about pain. I'm talking about the mental suffering, or it's that which makes, you know, us, we attach onto what we want, and then we don't get it, and then we suffer. And so I just heard this example from some teacher yesterday in a class there. So he's saying that, he said, if I promised to take care of everything that would possibly cause you any pain, like I'm going to take care of, I'm going to get you all the money that you need. I'm going to get you your job. Like everything's taken care of. Your kids are taken care of. You always have food, everything that you possibly need. I'm going to make sure that's all out there. All the external stuff in your life is taken care of completely. The only thing I need of you is I'm going to lock you every time I come into the room to check you out. You're just going to be in this room here. You need to be absolutely joyful. That's the only condition. So I'm going to take care of everything else. I'm just come in, and every time I need you to be completely 100% full of joy. And then the illustration, it kind of reveals people are going to be miserable. You can have everything in the world. Look at the people that have everything that they want.
Yeah.
They have all the money in the world. They're fucking miserable. So there's just something inherent about a self that suffers. It's never enough. It's the game of more, like Fred talked about on the podcast last week, which you guys don't know about this because it hasn't come out yet as we're saying this. That will make sense to people in the future. It doesn't make sense in this conversation. But the game of more that we're always playing, that no matter, like if everything is taken care of, we'll find a way to complain about it. We'll find a way that, well, it could be a little nicer in here.
Well, you know, this, you know what though? I've got
1,000 pounds of gold.
But you know what though? Nice. I don't know that to be true. I have not had that experience. I have not been given everything ultimately then to feel like I'm just being miserable. So how about y'all give that to me and then we'll see. We'll do a little test. So just give me all the money, give me all the power, and then we'll see. Maybe you're right, but maybe you're not.
Okay, but how about the times where you have gotten what you want? The times where you like got that record deal, when you had that thing happen that you really wanted to happen, and then did it like satisfy forever? Was it like, wow, it happened and now I'm just good?
I think it in some moments, yes. Like there's a contentment that comes, like a real gratitude and a thankfulness that you can have. Now, I think any new opportunity just naturally presents new problems. So with the record deal example, like when I got my record deal, I was really content and really satisfied. I'm like, I had been working my whole life to get this. Like I had always dreamt for like 15 years to get a record deal. And you know what? That moment felt good. I got, you know, I posted about it. I got to stun on the haters that said I'd never do nothing, be nowhere. Like I felt good. It felt good. So that's why I'm like, what are y'all talking about? Like miserable. Like that shit feels good when that happens. Now, you're right. There is a tendency for like the ego wants like, well, then now I want this or I want more. And, you know, like that. But those are just new opportunities based on that. Right. But like, I think you can experience like people say money doesn't bring happiness. I'm like, well, it depends on how much money you have, because I'm like, like if I have a private yacht where I can, you know, go, you know, riding on the little jet skis all the time, I'm gonna be happy. But I just will. Like money can actually bring some happiness. But I mean, ultimately, I guess in one sense you're right. Like there, because life is ever evolving. Like there will always be a sense of I want more, because we're living moment by moment, day to day. Like so, the sense for more, yes, can be a type of tyranny. It can be a type of greed. But also, I think folks can really experience contentment even, you know, in those types of scenarios where you're just thankful for what you have. You're thankful because, you know, you grew up poor and you know, like I'm thankful that I mean, I grew up working class, semi-poor. Like I'm thankful that I make more money now than my parents. You know, like there's a real contentment I have with that. I don't know. I could be wrong. I'm just talking.
Sure. And there are poor people who are very content being poor.
Yeah, exactly.
You go to...
Yeah, there are. I just told myself I'd never be one of them. So they can do that. But and if I am, and if life brings me there, okay, we'll figure it out. We'll make do. But like, you know.
This is one of my favorite existentialists and philosophers, Merleau-Ponty, talking about the four slices of existence: temporality, corporeality, relationality, and spatiality. And so I'm just listening to what you're saying as they intersect with each of those dimensions of existence.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how we are beings over time. That's the temporality piece. And how time naturally introduces new elements and we adapt to them. And I imagine there are, and sometimes resist them. I was just thinking about how I intersect with these ideas, and hunger being one of them. Like what it's like to want more of, let's say, a delicious dessert that I don't actually need more of, but tastes good. And is there anything wrong with wanting that more? And then how our corporality and temporality intersect to remind us that even if we eat now, that is never enough to sustain us for forever. We always need more tomorrow or tonight to remind us. And that hunger emerges to remind us that it's okay to need more, and that what we have in one instant shouldn't suffice for forever. And our bodies are constantly changing and needing more. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
So that was just the thought that I have. Like, I don't
know. There's nothing wrong with it. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I'm really into like Tantra these days, which is it. So you could frame that in tantric terms as far as like the goddess is that movement that always is more, that of the universe that is always moving towards. That's why life is suffering. There is this inherent, this is not enough. Let's eat again. Let's like, I want to survive. I want to keep doing this. That more is kind of built in, baked into the universe. But then there's also, so that's the goddess, that's the Shakti, and then there's the Shiva, which is the stillness underneath that. The stillness, the space in which that movement happens. So what that's the non-dual thing is to say yes to all of it, is to say yes to this, give me more of that dessert, and the experience of the stillness that's under there that doesn't need anything, that always just is. Because in this moment, in the very moment that we're in, there isn't, you get close enough into the moment and there isn't any movement. It's just stillness. Even as I'm looking at the more, ooh, what is that desire for more? And I go into it deep enough, closely enough, eventually it goes, and it's just the stillness. So both of it, both the movement, the more, the suffering, the non-suffering, I think it's just all part of the dance and the music of what is.
So. As you were talking, I felt curious about how much you think dissonance is a product of suffering or is an invitation out of suffering.
Could it be both?
Yeah, I was going to say both too.
So like... I mean, I've quoted this a few times on the podcast, but Maharaji, I love suffering. It brings me so close to God. What a funny, like, it's like being close to God is in some way like the lack of suffering, right? You're at home, but suffering is what brings you there. That dissonance is so beautiful to me. So to say, yes, there's this suffering that's causing all of this dissonance. And if you want to or need to avoid it, repress away and use all your coping mechanisms, fantastic. That's part of it too. And sometimes you'll get the space to go, wow, those two notes that I hated being together created this other warble with themselves that now became this like new reality. It's not just the two notes anymore. Now there's like a third space of the interaction of those two notes. The dissonance can actually create a third. Oh, look at that. It's kind of a Trinitarian thing, right? Father, Son, Spirit. Like there's not just the two. It doesn't just get caught on this linear static thing, but the present, it creates this third space in which...
Dynamism,
yeah. This has gotten obscure for a conversation about dissonance. Esoteric.
I don't know if it's obscure.
Okay, good.
It's confronting how I think about the work that I do, because some people think about therapy and psychology as being not only understanding human behavior, but changing it so that we can, suffer less, be more well, be more fully ourselves. But ultimately at the heart of that is this this idea of change, and it's really hard to support somebody. I'm feeling my connection to what I do as being inherently about change, and how the complexity of that coming through often being able to say to someone, you are so good as you are, even if you don't change. But in doing that, I'm trying to remind them of something that can rehabilitate a view of themselves, which helps them change.
Dissonance built into that. It's amazing.
Yeah. And to, I mean, I think about our emerging theories of psychopathology, like what is going on when people have mental health issues and the role of emotional dysregulation behind that, not knowing how to be with feelings, move them through us, stay with them long enough, manage them in ways that are appropriate to the context, and how cognitive dissonance is the name or the explanation for why we feel that uncomfortable feeling inside. But if we don't know how to be with that feeling, that's when we start to get away from things that might maybe not need to be avoided, or might get in the way of us resisting things that we do need to resist. So as I'm hearing you say all of this, I'm thinking about it in light of my work and what it would be like to, for us to build the capacity to tolerate that discomfort long enough that we could stay with it in that process where it becomes the dynamism, instead of like we fold or we resist, and what it's like to hang out in that space and that being an inherent process of change.
Yeah.
I don't have anything else to say. I'm just curious.
Girl, I don't know. I don't know.
I don't know is a you know, it's a step in a direction from I don't care what you guys think. Thanks for listening to the podcast, everybody. This is not the end of this conversation. We'd love to invite you to the Sunday thing this Sunday to join us for letting this kind of settle into the community and talking about dissonance together. The Sunday thing is a weekly Zoom meeting that we do with the liturgist community. You can check out more about that and all the other things going on in the liturgist community. Meditations and other podcasts and all kinds of stuff at theliturgists.com. We'd like to thank our patrons for making this episode and everything that we do here at the Liturgists possible. Your hosts have been William Matthews, Dr. Hillary McBride, and me, Michael Gunger. Thanks for listening, everybody.